Hello and welcome to Stump, Death and Taxes. This is Meep, also known as Mary Pat Campbell. I'm a life actuary. I don't want to talk death today. We've had plenty of death, and I'll be getting back to it soon enough. Today I'm talking public pensions and a misdirected focus on assets. Well, not necessarily. I'm going to talk about three different things that came to my attention in recent months, and I'm going to put them all together. I'm going to start with Edward Seidel, or Ted Seidel, who has been writing about fundraising to do a forensic audit of the Minnesota teachers' pension funds. The first piece was from March 11th, 2024. And I'll link to all of these in the show notes. Minnesota Teachers Fundraise Forensic Audit of State Pension System. So this is written by Edward Seidel. The subtitle is Minnesota Educators Are Concerned the Teacher Retirement Association that manages the statewide educator pension system may have mishandled assets. So this is a press release, and let me read it out. Minnesota educators are concerned that the Teacher Retirement Association, TRA, the body that manages the statewide educator pension system, has mishandled employee contributions. Despite increased teacher contributions and high investment returns, TRA has continued to report minimal gains and a 23.6% fund deficiency. Further mistrust stems from reports of hostile responses to requests for documentation, refusal to hold meetings when members are able to attend, closed-door conversations, providing misleading data, and a general lack of transparency. In response, educators have set up a GoFundMe account, a Minnesota TRA forensic audit fundraiser, to crowdsource the funds to hire attorney and pension expert Edward Ted Seidel to conduct a forensic investigation of TRA. TRA currently has 215,000 members. Pension contributions are self-funded through mandatory salary deductions. Inequitable funding commitments increase contributions and significantly decrease benefits for some, but not all members. Board bias and concerns that teachers may lose their pensions prompted the fundraiser. And then there's a little bit of promo for Ted Seidel and also about prior audits that he had conducted. Now, of course, he may expose some malfeasance on the part of the asset management for the pension fund, and he's done similar reviews. The question is, what are the possible outcomes? You know, let's say there's like too high fees, there's some kind of mismanagement. And I actually went in to look at what was going on here. And of course, I go to the pension database, the public plans database, which is publicplansdata.org. And of course, I'll link to this for Minnesota teachers. And I looked at this, looking at the assets. Oh, okay, it's growing. This is looking pretty good for the net assets. It spiked a little in 2021, but a lot of pension plans had that kind of spiking. The equity markets were hot that year, and it came down in 2022. Fine. Then we have number of actives per annuitant coming down. This is what's happening, nationally, that there are more and more pension beneficiaries, fewer and fewer actives. Now, this total membership is 172,000, so this is Minnesota Teachers. There may be another plan that goes with TRA, so to get to the 215,000. So I'm just going to move on. Maybe that's because this is actives and beneficiaries and it's not counting vested but not yet retired. So that's probably the situation. Okay, so then the cost, unfortunately, it only shows the employer annual required contribution. It's not showing the employee contribution on this graph. This is a relatively low percentage. Depending on what the benefit is And they're showing, you know, they're comparing it against other teacher plans. And it's true. Other teacher plans have much higher percentage of payroll. That's the required contribution from the employer compared to Minnesota. So that's making me think that the employees are having to make up the difference. And so I can see why they may be, the employees may be motivated to look into what's going on with their pensions. Now, the funded ratio for Minnesota teachers is having a trajectory that's pretty much on par with what's going on with other similar pension plans throughout the country, which is, it's just kind of hanging around. It was hanging around in the 70s for funded ratio, and now it's a little bit over 80%, as he was saying. I think he said 23.6%. 23.6% deficiency, and maybe that was overall, but for the valuation and for fiscal year 2022, it was really a shortfall of 18%, but that's okay. It's a timing issue. Maybe he's talking about 2023, and we don't have that in this database yet. I can believe it went down again to under 80%. That does happen. It does fluctuate. But now I'm starting to see where there may be an issue. And that's when I get to the pie chart about the asset allocations. And there's this huge chunk that's, what, 26.3% of the portfolio is labeled miscellaneous alternatives. And I'm like, huh. The about 50%, it's 48.7 of equities and 19.6 of fixed income and a little sliver of cash, 5.4% of cash. Those seem reasonable, but what is this huge chunk that's just labeled miscellaneous alternatives? And when we look at the time series of this miscellaneous alternatives, it jumped up in 2021 and went up a little higher in 2022. What's going on there? Again, I can see why they're calling some of this stuff into question. When you look at their annualized 5-year and 10-year return, it's actually higher than peer pension funds. But frankly, that's just a snapshot in time. When I'm looking at this miscellaneous alternatives, that may be a black hole with regards to performance. And then when I look at the net cash flow is a percentage of assets. These are negative numbers, and that's pretty common, but it's a very large negative compared to their peers. So the national average, and this is generally similar kinds of plans, is hanging around negative 2% to negative 3% of the assets. That's the national average, but Minnesota teachers started at negative 4% in about 2001. It dipped down. Its worst year, of course, like most pension plans, was in 2009 and dipped down to negative 7%. It's been improving since then, back up to negative 4% of the assets. So that's a cash flow situation versus comparable plans were at about negative 2% of assets. That is going to have an effect of what kind of contributions are going to be asking the teachers to be putting in. And if the employers are only putting in, and let me just see, about, and they paid 100% of what they're supposed to be putting in, but it looks like they're only putting in about 8% of payroll. And what are the teachers having to put in of their salary? So I can see why they're calling things into question. Ted Seidel did a follow-up piece titled Minnesota Teacher Pension Forensic Investigation Invites Whistleblower, Expert, and Public Participation. If you have information about management of the state teacher pension or its investments, we'd like to hear from you. So he's asking, you know, posting, you know, where they have a Facebook group, the Minnesota Educations for Pension Reform Facebook group is inviting public participation by posting all documents obtained from the pension and others, pursuant to public record requests online for public scrutiny, encouraging whistleblowers to come forward with information about the pension and its hundreds of Wall Street investment managers, welcoming knowledgeable industry experts to offer their insights and opinions, and by distributing educational material about pension management to the public. So one of the issues, and so again, there's more to this, and of course, given his expertise, Ted Seidel is focusing on the asset management side, and that makes sense. I'm going to be talking about other aspects of the public pensions, and it's not about the asset management side, though I do know about asset management. A lot of what is causing trouble with the public pensions is not the asset management. The returns for a lot of these pension funds are actually meeting their targets, though I am not happy about a lot of the alternative asset classes that are getting into some of the pension funds, because I call into question how much oversight the boards of trustees for some of these pension funds are able to actually exercise. So even though I'm not, the asset management is not what is actually causing the problem, it's a result of the underlying problem, is my argument. And so the second bit I'm going to talk about is Connecticut. And I'll just tell you what's coming up, Connecticut and then Chicago. In the case of Minnesota, there was a period that the employer was not doing, not paying the full contribution that they were supposed to be paying. That was part of the problem. I don't know what the nature of the benefits are for the Minnesota Teachers Plan in terms of what kind of retirement benefit are they promising, and then are there other types of benefits in retirement or disability or long-term care or anything? I don't know. And is that causing issues with the fundedness? That said, looking at their funded ratio and that it was just kind of hanging out at the upper 70s, 70 to upper 70s for a while and just barely crept up in recent years, I'm going to guess their inherent problem is the problem that most of the defined benefit pension plans have. You're promising lifetime income. A lot of the times they are doing a funding approach that is a level percent, that is trying to develop a level percent of payroll approach, amortizing unfunded liabilities with a certain built-in assumption that more will be paid later. So again, level percentage of payroll as opposed to a level dollar amount. And if certain assumptions are not met, that actually has a built-in result that you never seem to get anywhere, and you just kind of seem to be treading water. So there's a lot of public pension plans specifically that just tread water. They even if they make their full contributions that they are told they're supposed to make, even if their investment performance is good, they never seem to make it back to full fundedness. And almost all of these plans were over 100% funded in the fiscal year 2001. And most of them lost that by fiscal year 2009. And then by recent years, the best they've been able to do, and this is why my 80% funding myth has not really come back yet, but it may come back now because a lot of them have just crept up to about 80% fundedness. Now, I have an explanation for, let me just push the 80% fundedness myth to one side, but I have an explanation why all of these public pension plans are not really able to get back to full fundedness, even if they're doing everything they were told they were supposed to do. I would say the public pension actuaries have some explaining to do as to why the, you know, it was fully funded back in 2001 and now it's not, even if they're doing everything they were told they were supposed to do. Maybe you would like to explain that to the class. And it's not because of underhanded asset management. Okay, it's something fundamental to the defined benefit pensions and the funding approaches and the way these pensions are valued as well. I am waiting for the new actuarial reports to come out with the low default risk valuation approach with that number. That is not going to be used in the official GASB valuation number, but it will be in the actuarial report, and they're going to have to explain it. And I'm waiting to see. I have seen various framings coming up that with various spins, and I've got my own retort ready for that. And now you have already heard what I have said. You know, if you're not at 100% fundedness with the happy, I'm sorry, with your 7% discount rate, and you're not at 100% funding, and they have been making that full contribution all these years, and it's going to look even worse with that low default risk discount rate, and we all know that. Yeah, why aren't they at 100% fundedness at 7%? You tell me. Would you like to explain that? Because that's something you have to explain. So as I say, I wish Ted Seidel well with regards to the Minnesota Teachers Pension Funds. I think it's good to have people, outsiders, try to provide some oversight because public pension funds in general don't get enough oversight. You don't have a lot of third-party regulation of these funds, so having somebody come in like him is a good idea. But my main point, and I'm about to switch to Connecticut, is that what's really ailing a lot of these pension plans is not the asset management itself. You can clean it up and having these various, you know, outsiders coming in and say, hey, this is bad and let's do better. We'll clean up that one problem, but you'll find out that cleaning up that problem and doing things well does not solve the fundamental problem. So this past weekend, an op-ed ran in the Hartford Courant, Opinion 10 Recommendations to Reform Management of Connecticut Public Pension Funds. And this was written by a couple of people from the Yale Business School. Now let's see. This was by Jeffrey Sonnenfeld and Stephen Tian. And I'm just going to read the very beginning of this. Improvements in the state's historical investment underperformance can alleviate the crushing income tax burden of transferring $7.7 billion in surplus contributions from state tax revenues to pay down the pension burden and relieve state public employees and teachers from being docked an additional 2% of their wages each year to cover the investments hole. With even average performance in the past, Connecticut's income tax might have been sliced in half or more. Given the scale of this challenge, it is remarkable that decades of underperformance of Connecticut's pension funds escaped public notice and scrutiny for as long as it did, until last year, when we revealed in a 113-page research report how Connecticut's pension funds have had one of the worst investment track records of all 50 peer states across all timeframes, which garnered significant attention and calls to action from across the state. Given the asset management and endowment investing expertise in Connecticut, this was a tragic paradox. And so then, you know, they move on to a variety of things. So I'm going to move to two different things. So first off, that 113 page thing, it's really like a PowerPoint deck that has a bunch of pie charts. And guys, you're at Yale. Don't use the default Excel pie chart stuff. You guys can do better than this. I will teach you to make better graphs, for crying out loud. This was embarrassing. And gee whiz. In any case, these pie charts give me pain. I don't want to get hung up on these pie charts, though. But they kind of missed the point because they were like, oh, let's look at Connecticut, which is way down on the list, versus Washington. Look at Washington. Washington State does so much better. Without noticing. And, you know, they might say, well, Washington, if you go to the public plans database, the Washington State pension plans are near 100% funded versus the Connecticut plans are like 50% funded. The best one is the Connecticut Municipal, but that is not those investment, that's much smaller, and that is not managed, I believe, by the state investments. So let me take a look. Oh, it may have been because the returns are not so hot there. Okay, I'll get into how I found out about this op-ed and the discussion we had about this, but there's like one key problem of just focusing on the investment performance. And yes, one percentage point better over the long haul. Yeah, that definitely would have helped. But there's a fundamental issue here. And this is you're investing to support a liability. You're investing to support cash flows going out the door. And there's a key issue of a difference between the Washington State pensions and the Connecticut pensions. And the difference is their fundedness, and especially where they started. And the difference here is, unlike most other pension plans that are in the public pension database, they did not start out at 100% fundedness in 2001. And there's a history to that. And the history is, for decades, Connecticut did not fund their pensions. They did it as pay-as-you-go. There was a point at which they were like, oh, you mean we need to pre-fund these things? Or that it's a good idea? Which meant they were starting at, you know, they were starting at a bad place. So where everyone else started out at 100% or a little bit over 100% in 2001, the Connecticut Teachers Plan was starting out in 2002 at about 76% fundedness. And then the Connecticut State Employees, 63% fundedness. That's why they suck so bad. When you are so deeply underfunded, some people are like, oh, well, let's go to the casino. Let's do risk on, baby. Yeah, you could do that. That's not really a good idea. Yes, they could have done better with their investments. Not going to disagree. And their allocation, maybe that could have done some better work. And then within the specific asset classes, perhaps they could have performed better. I don't know. But when you have such deeply underfunded pensions, you do run a risk of, if you go risk on, of making things much, much worse for you in terms of having to dig out of a hole. Now, the cash flow situation was therefore very bad compared to, comparable plans. Now, they've been really hiking up the contributions, but it is a lot of money that they've had to put into the pension plans because for decades they weren't doing it. So that's a big point. They're like, a lot of these solutions that people are trying to come up with is to ignore that you actually have to contribute to the pension plans, that, no, these gee whiz solutions of, oh, let's just invest smarter. No, that is not going to solve it. So I became aware of this op-ed because my friend Spang Jr. on Twitter saw this, and he commented, these are excellent recommendations for professionalizing broken investment management, but fundamentally they would professionalize mismanagement. The asset portfolios exist to defease the liability, so the proper benchmark is the liability portfolio. We're not trying, and that was what he wrote. One of our other Connecticut friends, like, please don't get me started on this. Incompetent, unscrupulous, lying, self-interested, both for political purposes and their own personal enrichment. In a few glaring examples over the years, treasurers are the biggest issues. Reducing the elected treasurer's power, few states empower their treasurer like Connecticut does, and trying to get politics out of the office as much as possible is the major thing that needs to get done. No matter what any current or future treasurer does to improve things, any improvements are just an election away from being reversed by the next politician who comes into the office. It's just sad. In New York State, by the way, we have a single trustee for our state pension funds. It's the New York State Comptroller. And he's done pretty well, but it would be relatively easy for someone, a bad actor, to get in. It's just a single fiduciary. What's the oversight there? That's very poor governance structure. My own response is investment performance for Connecticut is the least of their problems, really. And I've seen real doozies over the years of following public pensions. One of the biggest problems the state funds has or had was that it went forever before deciding, whoops, we actually have to pre-fund benefits. That's been a hangover they've never got out from underneath because they thought they could always pay later what they promised long ago. Then we have the state subsidizing local teachers' pensions. This is Connecticut does this and Illinois does this as well. That's a recipe for disaster. It provides an incentive for districts to boost pay, which also boosts benefits. After all, somebody else pays. And then son of Dr. Spengler, jumps back in. All that is true. And there's another error happening here. Investment managers look at the portfolio and say, leave aside that actuarial stuff. Let's just do the easy step and optimize the portfolio. But that leads to worse outcomes because they optimize to the wrong thing. For example, a well-diversified portfolio reduces risk on a standalone portfolio. You can diversify by adding foreign equities, but for U.S.-based pension obligations, which have no international liabilities, this introduces foreign exchange risk that didn't exist before. Investment guys often miss the fact that liabilities are part of the portfolio and need to be included in the optimization. And so then I get back in. Only institutional investment folks used to ALM, which is asset liability management, LDA, that's liability driven. Liability driven investment, and SAA, strategic asset allocation, really think this way. We've got to support a stream of cash flows. They assume, so the people who are just optimizing for return are assuming the bondholders or taxpayers will always make good any shortfalls in the investment. So we've looked at Minnesota teachers. We've looked at Connecticut states, and again, this has all been asset focused in terms of trying to fix underfunded public pensions, more or less. Now we're going to look to Chicago. Here we go. Harris School of Public Policy at the University of Chicago. This is from April 5th, 2024, press release. Harris School of Public Policy announces policy innovation challenges, winning student-led pension proposal. A group of graduate students came together to propose a workable solution to Chicago's burgeoning pension liability. Here we go. The University of Chicago Harris School of Public Policy this week announced the winner of the inaugural Harris Policy Innovation Challenge, a competition which tasked students to devise innovative solutions to Chicago's largest financial problem, $35 billion in unfunded pension liabilities, a shortfall that ranks among the largest in the nation. The winning team, which received an award of $10,000 and was chosen at a live pitch event on April 3rd, was made up of graduate students Syed Ahmad, James Karsten, Liam Gluck, Greg Rudd, and Anthony Beaupre, and they were mentored by Jack Proffman, Executive Director for Global Treasury Operations at UChicago. The team's proposal to address Chicago's pension crisis included 1. Deregulating marijuana licensing to expand the number of dispensaries and resulting tax revenue. 2. Updating the process for vacant lot sales to increase transactions and taxes. 3. Increasing police and firefighter employee contributions to 11.5%. And 4. Adding a 75-cent toll to disable Lakeshore Drive. Okay. So then we have a bunch of stuff. So there were, and I did see that there were multiple finalists for this. And there's going to be an upcoming Harris Policy Forum entitled Fresh Insights on Pension Reform Solutions for Chicago. I will see if that's online. If it's online, I'll try to sign up for it. So, you know, good for them for trying. You know, there were, and I did see a variety of potential solutions mentioned. So in this case, it looks like it was all focused on the revenue. And you know what? Good for them to realize that contributions really needed to be increased. This wasn't about, fixing investments. I did see others listed, and I'm sorry, I need to find that. Okay, I found it. So there were three teams that made it to the finals, and they got to run op-eds in Crane's Business with regards to the winning solution. Okay, so they mentioned, so this is the Syed Ahmad, Anthony Beaupre, Liam Gluck, James Karsten, Greg Rudd. So this is where they had a variety of new revenue sources or increased revenue sources. They actually talked about their problem-solving approach. Using an approach from the private sector, we structured the problem into three parts, systematically evaluated nearly 30 potential solutions, arrived at a suite of 9 solutions for a recommendation. Altogether, we estimate these 9 have the potential to add approximately $200 million to $400 million to Chicago's coffer each year, a present value of $2.5 billion to $5 billion over 30 years. Moreover, we believe the ideas are relatively feasible. Each has been implemented in another state or city before. None requires extensive implementation, and all avoid heavy reliance on tax increases and benefit cuts. So I can see why this one was the winner. It seems to be, you know, relatively, you know, it has multiple items, and therefore one could pick and choose different items. And now what's interesting, there was one bullet in here that was not mentioned in the final, and I see this in the op-ed, require that all assumptions underlying the city's required contribution are set by actuarial recommendations rather than by political decisions. I wonder how that went over. Okay. But let's look at the other two op-eds. So to fix Chicago's pensions, consider a change in public opinion. This was by Eddie Andujar, Andy Fan, Andre Oviedo, and Alberto, I'm sorry, I'm not going to say this right, Saldarriaga. So in this one, they're saying pensions are still public employees' primary source of retirement income. Because of a historical categorization of pensions as low priority, the city has fostered a landscape where a lack of accountability and constitutional barriers have amounted to a current pension deficit of $35 billion. So, our team solution addresses what we believe are the two root causes, a lack of public will and below requirement pension funding. The first proposed intervention is a simple low-cost awareness campaign dedicated to disseminating key information about this issue through easily accessible channels. In many ways, we hope this article itself will be part of this conversation. The second intervention focuses on increasing the city's revenue sources. To rally popular support, we need an intervention that not only taps into people's sympathies for public employees, but also one that aligns with their own economic incentives. A progressive income tax across the state would alleviate some of the tax burden for more than 80% of Illinois residents, while netting a yearly revenue increase of upwards of $6.4 billion. Okay, yeah, so I could see why this one may not have won, because politically, this may be infeasible. As sympathetic as people might be, getting this to pass in the entire state to pay for Chicago pensions, given how big the hole is for Illinois state pensions, yeah, that's gonna be a heavy lift. And then the third group, Two Paths to Funding Chicago's Pension Future by Anna Weiss, Purva Sarkango, and Devyanshi Dubey. Let's see here. To reach the 90% funded ratio by 2059 is stipulated by the Illinois Pension Code, stave off the worst consequences of the unfunded pension crisis, Chicago must designate a reliable revenue stream for supplemental contributions. To accomplish this goal, we propose two policies in tandem. First, the city should codify annual advance payments into state law, as Cook County did in 2023. Codifying advance payments is necessary to ensure the annual budget will prioritize pension liabilities. Just as important, advance payments demonstrate fiscal responsibility and prudence, signaling to credit rating agencies and other stakeholders that Chicago is committed to managing its liabilities effectively and meeting its long-term obligations. This can, in turn, prompt improved credit ratings, lower borrowing costs, and increase investor confidence, all positive signs for the city's future financial outlook. Second, we propose a more politically viable revenue generation solution, the creation of a public safety tax that would support the Office of Public Safety Administration and the Chicago Police Department. While taxes directly increase revenue, they often face political resistance. Creating a tax solely for pension repayment would likely encounter opposition, as it would further burden taxpayers who do not directly benefit from pensions. However, introducing a tax for a universal, more politically acceptable purpose, such as in this case public safety, could redirect funds within the budget to bolster pension contributions. This public safety tax would be a flat 1% income tax for Chicago households. Okay, yeah, I can see that one wouldn't be very popular either. So I can see why the team that won. The other two have some very big political sticking points that are unlikely to go very far. So I could see that the ideas that they have in this first group, they have a couple different revenue sources that may be popular. So they actually have some different things here that were not announced, like securitizing another stream of tax revenue as done with the sales tax in 2017. I don't think that's a good idea. Revamp processes to collect on the $6 billion plus in debt owed to the city. Traffic tickets, for example. Okay, that could be popular or not. That requires collections. They did talk about employee contributions, marijuana licensing, selling vacant lots. I could see that one being a popular approach. So, interesting mix. You know, I like the approaches taken in that, you know, they did actually take this seriously. None of them touched having to change the actual benefits, because that actually would require a constitutional amendment. So none of them approached that. So that was realistic. Very good. But you can see none of them said, oh, let's improve the investment returns. These all were somewhat realistic, even if some of the solutions may be politically unpopular, and they knew that. But it is interesting, because this is something that is going on in Chicago right now. They do need more revenue, more contributions in their pension plans right now. Connecticut needed those contributions right now. And Minnesota, it's actually in the situation that a lot of the pension plans are, that they've just been hanging around between 70 to 80% funded and not really getting anywhere. And they're about to see a number that is just going to blow their mind when it comes out in the actuarial, reports. And I'm sorry, some of us, yeah, we're waiting for those numbers and we're going to have some fun with it. So that's been Stump. Death and Taxes, and we'll see what I talk about next time. Bye-bye.